session number 22676, Reel 3.
Major Hutton, Reel 3.
Yes, I'm sorry to correct you over the NASA nationalized canal. I'm open to historical correction, but I think that NASA was actually Farouk was actually on the throne, and that the WAFT, now there was a prime minister, well-known prime minister of the WAFT party, that was done by them.
Well, don't worry about that, because that's all in the books.
Yes,
we'll stick to your personal experience.
Yes. Yes. Well, I won't say very much about our time in Egypt, because, in fact, it was a very boring one for troops. Parachute troops should not be used, really, to guard installations and so on and so forth for months and months on end. We had a rather better time than other troops in the Canal Zone, and there were many troops there. There were two full infantry divisions and the Parachute Brigade and the Marine Commando Brigade at one time. That we could get out of Egypt on exercises because we could fly out. And there was one memorable exercise where we dropped in Jordan, and those were the days when Glub Pasha was the commander of the Arab Legion, and King Hussein was a young man, and Glub agreed to provide the Arab Legion as enemy, and he promised he'd withdraw all live ammunition and only issue them with blanks. As exercise enemy, and we landed at an open stretch of desert south of a place called Mafraq, between Mafraq and Amman, and did this exercise with the Arab Legion as enemy, which was quite fun. Very hot there, and at the end of the exercise, we marched past Glub, very scruffy lot we were, after hot and dusty after a 3-day exercise. And were then flown out again after spending a day off duty in Amman, which was quite fun. We also did one or two parachute exercises over Cyprus, which was very pleasant. And the most fun in the way in the Canal Zone was with the sport, because being so many troops there, the sport was intensely competitive. So I won't say very much more about it. It was a long and boring time in many ways. We had very poor accommodation. There were so many troops and so many of us there that the far too many for the few barracks that there were. So that the RAF had all the best accommodation, because their airfields had been built before the war and had very comfortable accommodation. But the army was stuck out in tents in the desert mostly. Which wasn't very pleasant in hot weather, particularly during the high winds there called the Khamsin, blowing sand through one's tent and over all one's belongings. And there were also bed bugs. That I think is probably enough for Egypt. I enjoyed my time in the parachute regiment enormously. I was lucky enough to have the Vickers machine gun platoon for most of my time there, which was a thoroughly good job. Good job, one of the better jobs for a young officer in the battalion. And I then went home, and I really did get some home service then. I was at home from 1954 to 1960. So I became quite a home service soldier for 6 years. I don't know if you want to know anything about that, because it was a fairly humdrum sort of life. I was adjutant of the Light Infantry Depot at Strensville, just outside York. The only memorable thing that happened there was that at our regimental bicentenary, the Queen Mother, who was our Colonel in Chief, and this is particularly topical at this very moment, came and joined the celebrations at Strensville. It required a great deal of preparation, of course, for that, and we were very proud to entertain her that day. So that's the only thing I can remember about time at Strensville, except getting very involved with Yorkshire cricket and even playing in the same team one day as Sir Leonard Hutton himself. Not that I was anything like good enough to normally be in that company, but he lured himself occasionally to play in an invitation club match, and I played with him for Sir William Worsley's 11 against the Isengari. And that's a memorable day of my life. And I still got the batting order slip that was from the up on the dressing room door, headed by L. Hutton and little Leodiana J. Hutton. I caught a catch off his bowling. He loved bowling, Leonard. I caught a catch off his bowling and was congratulated by the great man. I think that's that will do for my over 2 years as adjutant at the Leytonshire Depot. I was lucky enough actually during that time to have two trips away. One was when a light infantry and Royal Artillery party joined the destroyer Corunna on its first visit to a Spanish port since before the Civil War, and we of course visited Corunna and sounded last post and reveille over the grave of Sir John Moore, possibly for the first time, because in the words of the poem, not a drum was heard nor a funeral note, etc., etc. So Sir John Moore had been in my regiment, the 51st of Foot, and so this is why we're privileged to do this. That was my first outing. The second one really was a much more important one, where I was, as I'd just passed into the Staff College, I was lucky enough to be selected to go to Australia with the party of British officers only. One had to be positively vetted and everything before that, to go to witness the nuclear trials at Maralinga in Central Australia, run by Sir William Penny, the famous nuclear physicist. There's really quite a lot to tell about that.
Please, if you would.
Yes. It was, of course, as a trip, it was enormous fun, because we were hosted by the Australians, who thought it was a tremendous lark as well, and Australians can be enormous fun themselves. They pitched an 18-section marquee as the mess tent, and the whole length of it was a bar, in true Australian fashion. And in those days, they were very keen to promote their wines and ports and so on, which were unheard of in Europe at the time, of course, widely drunk now. We were in this camp on the edge of the Nullarbor Plain, about 30 miles from the nuclear testing grounds. Some of the time, during the first few days, we had lectures from Sir William Penny and his staff on what it was all about. Quite a lot about how atom bomb was made and its effects and the various effects of fallout, blast and heat and so on and so forth. And then we were taken for trips up to the nuclear range. The nuclear range consisted of Ground Zero, which was a tower on which the first nuclear device, a 20 kT, was to be detonated. And in the area around the tower, up to a distance of about a mile, at intervals and at various ranges, was a range of Army and Air Force equipment, dummy aircraft, Centurion tanks, not dummies, real ones, guns, dummy men, men in trenches, men in pillboxes and under protection, every kind of test of equipment to see the effect on it. Those were the days when there was possibly a real threat of nuclear war in Northwest Europe. We were facing the Eastern Bloc with NATO, and nuclear weapons were very much on the menu for possible use in anger. And the reason we and the Australians and New Zealanders were having this period of indoctrination, as they called it, was so that there would be a nucleus of army officers could go back and train others when we got back in what we'd learned. So we sat there in this camp in the South Australian desert, and the days ticked by and the weeks ticked by, because the direction of the wind was never quite right for the device to be exploded, detonated safely any habitations. We were a very, very long way from anywhere, but of course they didn't want fallout on Alice Springs, which was probably the nearest major settlement. And of course when nuclear dust goes up into the jet stream, which is several thousand feet up, the jet stream carries it very fast the direction the wind's going, and of course you have to be very careful that nothing you won't affect it in the way. So we, instead of waiting a week or 10 days, we waited a whole 3 weeks before it was detonated, and that was of course a sight one will remember all one's life. We were put at 9,000 yards was our sort of observation point, right quite in the open, with a very good view, of course, of the range. In the usual army way, we were put out very early in the morning, a long time before anything was going to happen. We knew it was a long wait, and they were the most interesting situation where I played a rubber bridge. We sat on the ground with a couple of packs of cards, four of us, and we played bridge waiting for the nuclear device to go off. And then the time approached, and immense excitement, of course, and we knew exactly how we were going to have to behave. We would hear the countdown, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, and so on, and we would be facing away from the range because of the victim one's eyes. Because you mustn't look at the thing for 2 seconds. We then get the countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, about turn. And on the about, of course, it's at 1-0 about turn. And on the zero, there's the most blinding flash you've ever seen. And the whole landscape, and you're looking away from the thing, is as though 1,000 neon lights have been lit up. This only lasts for a second, and then you turn round, and at the same time you have felt the heat on the back of your neck, and one doesn't realise that heat travels the same speed as light. I believe there's a fractional difference, but you felt the heat on the back of the neck at the same moment as the explosion, and then you turn round and you see this absolutely shattering sight of the mushroom cloud developing, still a orange glow in the middle, and clouds of black smoke going out for about for a diameter about a mile across, because it just incinerated the whole bush, because it was a bush-like desert, incinerated the whole bush a mile across. This was all in a matter of seconds, which was, of course, the heat and fire effect of a nuclear device is probably the most terrifying, terrifyingly effective. Then you wait several seconds and you hear the boom, which is a violent roar, that passes, and then you just stand there in amazement watching the mushroom cloud developing and going up, farther up and wider into the stratosphere, so one has really seen something which very few mortals have seen, I suppose, in terms of thousands, perhaps many, that many, but one is one of the few. We didn't stay, most of us didn't stay to watch any further trials, but there were some officers selected to actually be more out on the range, and sit in the tank and so on. We're much smaller, 2 kiloton. This was a 20 kiloton. We'd witnessed a 2 kiloton was set off, and there were officers at much closer range experiencing that. After 2 days, we were taken out on the range and dressed in protective clothing, boots and masks and everything, and walked around the area of fallout to see the effect on the equipment and how much it had moved, and the Centurion tank had been pushed about 4 meters, 4 meters sideways. It's a 50-ton tank, and so on and so forth. And we took a great interest in that. And then we went through a decontamination procedure with Geiger counters and this, that, and the other, and had showers and was scrubbed clean. And I've had a very minor Runcheon count, which we all had, and was slightly radioactive. I'm glad to say, had any effect on my subsequent activities or health. And we then went back to camp, and then were flown out. And unfortunately, we were going to be given leave after the to go anywhere in the world we liked after the test, but had been delayed so long that I only had 4 days left. When I was required back in UK, some people had wonderful trips and went to New Zealand and went slowly back through across the United States and Canada. We were given one's return BOAC ticket. If you wanted to go, if you wanted to stray off a direct route back, you had to pay the excess. But I flew from Sydney to Fiji, Honolulu, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and then back, all in the space of a very, very few days. It was extremely tiring. But in those days, long before the gap years and so on and so forth, were flying to vast distance was very, very expensive, and very few people were doing the tourism that we're so used to now, had really not taken off at all. So I got back, having experienced places and had tales to tell at home, and was quite a hero when I got home.
Did you wear any protective gear when the explosion occurred?
None at all. No. 9,000 yards, provided you don't look at the flash when it's first done, you are quite safe. From a 20 kt, mind you, a 20 kt is an atom bomb as opposed to an H bomb. An H bomb is a much far, far more destructive device. This was the same size as the bombs that had destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Do you know the date of this test?
The date?
Yes.
I would have said that it was probably about September the 30th, 1956. About then.
What were you supposed to report back once you got back to England about what you'd learned?
Well, we had we had precis and photographs, and we were supposed to lecture on in abbreviated form on what we'd learnt from Sir William Penny and his staff, and the actual experience we had, and the our own observations. I think it's disappointing that we weren't used more. I was used very little for this, very little.
Who were you supposed to report the experience to?
Whomever the senior officers, who were the formation commanders, were considered it suitable to be divulged to. But you see, from my point of view, I went straight to the technical staff college at Shrivenham for a pre-staff college, 10-week pre-staff college technical course, where I was a learner. I think that there were one of the instructors on that knew as much as I did about what I had to tell. And then at the staff college itself, I was at the staff college for a whole year, 1957. Then again, I was a small fry there, and there were senior officers instructors who'd been on the test with me. So I wasn't ever really personally used. Others were. If I'd gone straight back to a unit with them to play in Rhine Army, I might well have been used extensively to lecture.
Were there any modifications to Army equipment as a result from what was learned in the test?
I shouldn't think so. I think they just wanted to know the effect that would be on it. That I don't know.
What's happened to you next? What's happened to you next in your career?
I went after a year at the Staff College. I went as Brigade Major to the Northumberland Territorial Brigade, and was based in Newcastle-on-Tyne. That was a normal staff job as brigade major to territorials, where there were three rather understrength battalions in the brigade, and I was doing a normal job, assisting the brigadier to run his formation and the battalions under his command, to train and administer. And that was my job up there. Pleasant period, but not of any great military significance.
And then?
They tried to poach me. The light infantry headquarters tried to poach me, because I was due to go out to my battalion in Germany. When I left the job in January, left the job in Newcastle in January, and I went to Shrewsbury first of all to command the sort of special company there, which had the NCO's training unit in it and the band boys and so on and so forth, to tide me over, because I think that the commanding officer of the Somerset and Cornwalls, and remember I'd had some time with the Cornwalls, he tried to poach me to go out and command a company there, but I said no, I wanted to go to my own regiment, and so I went, and I went out there in May to my regiment, which was serving in Hilden in Germany, which is just outside Dusseldorf, as the non-guards infantry battalion in the 4th Guards Brigade. The 4th Guards Brigade consisted of two guards regiments. I think to start with, we had the Coldstream and the Grenadiers, I think, or the Welsh. I forget in which order they were, but they changed around while I was there. And I was served with them from May 60 until the following summer. In September 61, the regiment came home prepared to go out to Malaya again.
Did you go to Malaya for a second time?
Yeah, but the emergency was over, and we were training in case British troops were sent to Indochina to support the Americans. And we were training in the jungle, which is a lot more boring and hard work than operations. Because operations, you go where the operational situation demands, and your training, you go where some blooming exercise commander sends you, which can be a lot less interesting. But I quite enjoyed. Because the time in Germany actually was very conventional training with troops and armoured divisions and so on and so forth. In support of armour and this, that, and the other in West Germany, and so many people have experienced that my experiences are of really little note. I did one thing I always longed to do was to speak German fluently, and I did, because I learned a lot of German at school, and I did try and learn German, but you see, when you're living entirely in a English community and your social life is almost entirely English, it's very hard to get to speak normal German, conversational German with intelligent Germans. One can get by in shops and restaurants and so on. In fact, my Speisenkarte Deutsch, my menu Deutsch, and ordering a meal is still very fluent. But that's really the I have little of note to report from Germany. It's a good station in many ways. You've got a car, you've got the whole of Europe, so your footstool if you wanted to take a long weekend, so on and so forth.
What were relations like with the Germans?
Oh, very friendly at that time. Yeah, they'd just joined NATO, and they were very proud that they were very pleased that they were being embraced by the West. They were more difficult. My first time in Germany, they were much more difficult in 46-47, but by 1960 Germany was prosperous again by then.
What was the nature of the difficulties in the 40s?
Well, I don't think there wasn't really hostility, because the Germans, in fact, then they were suffering. They were suffering. They were very short of food. They were very short of fuel. The Germans then were really an underclass. They were a complete underclass to the occupying forces. And we didn't mind. We felt they thoroughly deserved it at that time.
Was there any friction with them, though?
No. No. Germany was utterly defeated and destroyed. We made a very, very thorough job of it, for better or for worse. Whether unconditional surrender was the right political objective or not is for history to decide, not for me.
Should we go on next to your period in Oman?
Yes, I don't think there's very little to report of our second time in Malaya. We were brigaded with an Australian battalion, New Zealand battalion, which was, of course, a great experience to serve with them. They were very select troops. It was a plum job to be selected to go to the Commonwealth Brigade for them. And they were a very fine lot, those two battalions. And I think we probably learnt a bit from them. And it was competitive, sport was competitive. And I think we enjoyed our time there. I left just in time.
What specifically did you learn from them?
They have a very realistic attitude to field training, realistic and common sense attitude to field training. I think that's what we learned most from them. British Army isn't that good at field training. It needs a lot of because vast numbers of the troops come from towns. They're tinies. They're not used to fields and woods and things. And we need a baptism of fire to train the British Army in field training, I think.
Did you then go to Oman?
Yes. Once again, I was serving too long abroad. I was really entitled to spell at home. I was invited to volunteer for Oman, because at that time the Sultan didn't approve of European women. He thought they were a terrible distraction to his Muslim natives, and so there were no wives, girlfriends, or anything there. But so they went for the bachelors. So, and I thought I was going to be had for a sucker to accept that. But fortunately, I met someone who'd been there, and he said, "Grab it," and so I did, and it was the best 2 years of my army career out there, because it was a wonderfully free life. You were away from the British Army, because the Sultan's Armed Forces is independent of the British Army, although it does, half its officers were seconded officers, and the other half were contract officers who weren't actually serving British officers. And there were Pakistani officers as well, very few. A lot of Pakistani NCOs in training and administrative jobs. The troops were half Arab and half Baluch, mainly because the Sultan had a lot of trouble with tribes and tribal loyalties and inter-tribal strife. So it was his policy to recruit from Baluchistan, recruit troops from Baluchistan, so that at least half the army were, as mercenaries, would do what they were told. So that was the basis of Sultan's Armed Forces in those days. There are vast numbers of people who've served in SAF since then, because of the climate. It's usually a rather short tour of 2 or 3 years. There are many people who've got know a great deal more about the country than I do at its present time. One remembers this enormous exercise that's just taken place there. And it's a much more developed country now, than vastly more developed than when I was there. It was a very backward country indeed when I went there in early 63. There were no telephones, there were no roads. They were dust tracks. The only motor transport were the services, otherwise it was camels and donkeys. There was only one hospital in Muscat, and that was run by the Americans. There was no social security, no post or telegraphs. To make it sound too bad, there was a sort of there was a medical aid post in the tribal areas, medical aid posts around the place, but they weren't hospitals. They could just dispense. And it was the Sultan's policy that the army should be in complete control of the country. He just, when I went there, the what they call the Jebel War had only been over for a year or two, and that the